Second case this morning. U.S. versus Carter.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I will be arguing Issue 1, and Mr. Ravitz will be arguing Issue 3 in our joint brief. Judge, the defendants were convicted here of carjacking, and the statute has very specific mental state requirements. At the time that they take the vehicle, that they intend to cause death or serious bodily harm. We specifically asked the judge to instruct the jury that that was a necessary element prior to conviction. The government proposed an instruction that eliminated the intent to cause death part of the mental state, and the judge gave an instruction that eliminated that requirement. We believe that by doing that, the judge altered the mental state that is required for commission of the offense, and that therefore the defendants are entitled to a new trial on both the carjacking offense as well as the 924C offense, which was based on the carjacking offense. Judge, the statute is clear. That is the intent required. The United States Supreme Court in Holloway, in explaining this intent, said that the defendants had to have at the moment that they took the vehicle the intent to kill or cause serious bodily harm on the victims. That's why we asked for the instruction. We track precisely the statutory language, which was approved in Holloway, approved in this court in Jones, and the government did not want the jury to have that instruction. The judge did not believe that instruction was appropriate, that was sufficient.
Counsel, let me just ask you, suppose your instructions had been given to this jury, and the jury had responded with a question, in essence, is it enough if we agree that the defendants intended to cause serious bodily harm if the victims resisted? How should the court answer that question?
I think the judge should have answered that question no, that there is a single mental state in this case, and the mental state is the intent to cause death or serious bodily harm.
And that so is, that if the defendants, let's say they're on tape, okay? They have a pre-attack videotape of their intentions. Okay. Just totally fanciful here, but this is going to be their defense if they get caught. We'll videotape our thoughts. Our plan is that if we're going to carjack somebody and if they resist, we will shoot them in the leg. Are they innocent of carjacking if they follow through?
They're innocent, Judge, if the jury comes to believe that they did not intend to cause death or serious bodily harm. What Your Honor is trying to do, with all due respect, is what the government tried to do, which is to eliminate half of what the statutory language is.
Well, the question tries to give weight to the word or.
I understand that, but in every case, in every pattern instruction of every circuit that has a pattern instruction, nobody simply says serious bodily harm is enough. And the other way to look at it, and I think this would be, and the government even would agree with this, I believe, that if we had said to the judge, the or means that that it has to be either intent to kill or, so we want just half of it, intent to kill. They would have said you can't have intent to kill because when Congress put the or in there, they were describing some species of intent different than just merely an intent to kill. In other words, it would just be just as wrong for me to say to this court that the jury had to find a specific intent to kill the Andersons, as it is wrong for the government to say it's sufficient for the defendants just to have intended to cause serious bodily harm.
What you want is that you want the whole thing.
I want what Congress said a defendant
okay,
had
now,
to have.
How does that benefit the defendant?
Sorry?
How does that benefit the defendant by having the whole
Because what I think when the jury hears and when the jury understands the meaning of intent to cause death or serious bodily harm, it's more significant It is more significant than just to cause somebody serious bodily harm.
So when somebody puts a gun to the head and says, I'm going to kill you, you're just kidding or something.
If you're asking me whether the error is harmless, I certainly can address that, Your Honor, whether if under the facts of this case, even a properly instructed jury, then that's a separate inquiry. And if that's what you're asking, Your Honor, it was not a harmless error. And the reason it was not harmless is because Holloway recognizes, the Supreme Court of Holloway recognizes, that even express threats of death do not satisfy the requirement of intend to cause death or serious bodily harm unless the jury believes that the person intended to act on those threats. So even Holloway recognizes that that a jury might think, well, when he said that, he didn't really mean it. He was trying to scare and intimidate the Andersons. And, of course, fear and intimidation is also an element of the offense, a different element, but it also is required. So Holloway even recognized that. So now this court in Jones recognized that even pointing a gun at the victims is not in itself sufficient to satisfy that intent to cause death or serious bodily harm. Now, So what I'm saying is that the jury should have been told this is what you have to prove, and that it means more than just intending to cause serious bodily harm. And in this case, when you look at the facts, there's a lot of evidence that these defendants had no intention to actually harm the Andersons physically.
Well, first of all, they got the money, they got everything else, they got the car. In other words, the Anderson totally relented. Now, we can't speculate and say, no way.
Well,
you got a gun to your head? No. I'm not getting out of the car. You don't get my money. Get out of here.
The question here on appeal is whether a reasonable jury, looking at these facts, would have concluded that these two defendants never had the intent to seriously harm or injure the Andersons.
And to that extent, what do we look at?
Well, first of all, you look at the conduct of the defendants. When Mrs. Anderson, for example, was confronted by Mr. Carter on her side of the vehicle, She said, I wasn't really afraid, and she's walked away from the defendant. He told her it was stick-up time, and she walked away. So she resisted his initial approach. Not only did she walk away, she walked to the other side of the vehicle. No harm came to her. No extra threat was made to her. She wasn't shot, physically injured, beaten, pistol-whipped. You know, one doesn't have to look long at the reported decisions in these kinds of carjacking cases to know that there's a big, big leap between threatening someone and some of the things that we see, beatings,
shootings.
Well,
whether the victim wants to take a chance.
Well, it's right. And I think the jury should have been asked that question, and the jury should have been allowed to make that call. On appeal, the question is, could a reasonable jury have come to the opposite conclusion given a proper instruction? And I think based on that evidence, based on that conduct, based on the fact that they weren't in fact physically harmed, they weren't in fact shot. You know, when Mrs. Anderson makes a sudden movement reaching into the vehicle, she wasn't harmed, she wasn't threatened, she wasn't shot. Nothing,
there
was no escalation.
Wasn't she reaching for her purse, you mean, or what?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't she reaching for her purse?
She went to unlock the vehicle.
Well, that's after...
Right, but she went to the other side of the vehicle where my client was.
They couldn't get in the
weapon.
Car they were about to take, I guess.
But in no way were they confronted with the kind of harm, physical force, shooting, that the statute, that a reasonable jury could say the statute requires. The government now says the case is overwhelming.
Your time has expired.
But they didn't let the jury make the decision, and that's what we asked for. Thank you.
Please, court, counsel, Steve. I'm Gary Ravitz. I represent Jeffrey Carter. And as Steve mentioned, I'll be talking about the third issue we raised, which is a claim by the defendants that the district judge erred when he failed to sever count 4, 922G count, against Mr. Carter from the trial of the other counts in this case. It's our position the judge erred in two respects. One, a somewhat technical error involving the joinder principles under Rule 8. Secondly, and beyond that there is an error under Rule 14 because of the prejudice that flow to the defendants as a result of the refusal to sever. Specifically, as a result of that, the government put in evidence of a second armed robbery involving a gentleman named Mr. Garcia. We think that that was pretty thinly veiled propensity evidence, and in this case, tipped the balance in favor of the government with respect to all the counts, including the carjacking count that Steve just discussed for the last few minutes. So the remedy, in our view, again, is a new trial based on the denial of a fair trial for that reason. Now, let me turn first to the joinder count. In its brief, the government claims that the joinder issue has been waived by the defendants. I would simply ask the court to consider our response at page 19 of our reply brief. I think this issue was fully and fairly presented to the district court. Certainly the government in its pleadings argued this was a Rule 8B issue. The judge had all the arguments and information needed to make that call, and he made that call in this case. So there is no waiver of that issue. Our problem with the in terms of 8B is this, that the way the government charged it is that each defendant was charged with a 922G violation, but they separated the counts. So at least as to count four, there is no identity between the defendants as to that 922G. It only affected Carter. And as to the other counts in the case, this court has held that the fact that 922G is charged doesn't necessarily mean it's part and parcel of carjacking or the 924C in this case. So we think as a technical matter, then this case should have been severed. Count four should have been severed under Rule 8.
We are talking about two guys who were together over the relevant 90 minutes or so, right?
Yes.
Okay. Why isn't that sufficient to join the counts?
Because I think the way the government charged it, they charged it as simply a count against Carter that didn't affect Mr. Willis, at least as to count four. And keep in mind,
why is that a problem?
Because as a result of that, the government then used count four to put in evidence of an uncharged armed robbery. That's really what we see the problem being here.
Was it Willis that was prejudiced, but Carter was not? Is that what you're saying?
In terms of the robbery evidence?
Yes.
Both defendants were prejudiced.
Okay. But so why does the fact that they're separate counts three and four such a problem?
Because four is the trigger for a bad turn of phrase, I guess, in this case. Mm-hmm. But it's the reason why the armed robbery evidence of Garcia was admitted in the first place. You don't need that if for purposes of count three. Look at the evidence of 922G. You have the Anderson saying there was at least constructive possession of a gun by these two defendants. In fact, Mrs. Anderson called 911 and said each one of them had a firearm in this case. You have my client's post-arrest statement by the state authorities on the Anderson piece, in which he acknowledges a gun. You've got the testimony of Milton Latham, who's in a van, and also talks about the presence of a gun in a van with Mr. Carter and with Mr. Willis, and of course you have the police who recover a gun from a van in which Mr. Willis and Mr. Carter had been running. Certainly there's sufficient evidence available to the government that would not have prejudiced a fair trial to these defendants to permit the government to prove the 922G count without introducing the Garcia robbery evidence.
Well, going to get their names mixed up, which was Willis and Carter. Who is the passenger? Who was the guy without the gun?
Mr. Carter.
Yeah, okay. Carter comes across, around and takes all of Anderson's money and wallet and everything else while Willis is there holding the gun.
Right.
Now, doesn't he, in effect, using the gun, too? He's able to strip him down, take all his money and stuff, and the other guy's holding the gun. So he's benefiting from the other fellow holding the gun.
Well, there are two questions. One is, you know, with respect to 922G, I think maybe that was sufficient evidence for the 922G count, but not as to the Garcia robbery. That's really...
You're just trying to show where the gun was still possessed as they went along, I think, weren't they? Wasn't there some dispute about the identity of the gun?
Well, there was, and we raised that as a separate issue with respect to 924C, because the unusual aspect of this case with respect to the 924C charge is that the government identified a specific gun by serial number, and we think failed to prove then a link between the gun charged in the 924C count two, and the gun that is then discussed in terms of the 922G charges, both in count 3 and in count 4. So we think there was a sufficient failure of proof with respect to establishing that the gun in the van was, in fact, the gun used in the vehicular hijacking of the Andersons, which was a necessary element under count 2. So our position, though, on the 922G is a little bit different. I mean, I guess I would say, as to your question about Jeffrey coming around the car and seeing his cohort holding a pistol, it still goes back to the issue that Steve presented, which has to do with the intent in this case. And we don't think that the instruction permitted the jury to make a fair determination of that claim. And in Jeffrey's case, too, there was an aiding and abetting layer on top of that, because obviously he didn't possess a gun, and as I think Mr. Chobat explained to you, did not really undertake any acts personally that would suggest either an intent to kill or to cause great bodily harm. I see my time is up, so unless the court has further questions, I thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Ryan Hedges on behalf of the United States. Defendant's convictions and sentences in this case should be affirmed. The federal carjacking statute prohibits the taking of a vehicle by force or intimidation with intent to cause death or serious bodily harm. Now, an important fact in this case is that the defendants were charged in count one of the indictment with taking the victim's vehicle with intent to cause serious bodily harm only. Consistent with the statute, and with the indictment, the district court instructed the juries that the government had to prove the defendants took the victim's vehicle with intent to cause serious bodily harm if they didn't turn over the vehicle. Those instructions correctly stated the law. And in United States versus Jones, this court expressly concluded that the mens rea requirement for the statute is satisfied by a finding of intent to do the driver harm had he not complied with the defendant's demands. It says nothing about requiring an intent to kill.
And this sounds like we don't need that phrase at all.
Which phrase, Your Honor?
Intent to kill.
Well, Your Honor, I think the reason that intent to kill is in there, there are penalties that are provided under the statute depending on the outcome of the crime. Mm-hmm. And I think there are escalated penalties if a death does result. And so the statute takes into account those different types of mens rea that could result in a violation of the statute. And really, the Ranum case that we pointed out on this issue makes this pretty clear. A statute can have different mens rea requirements for a violation. In that case, it was actually a federally funded student loan case. And the defendant was charged with obtaining those funds by making false statements to obtain the funds. The statute provides that a violation can be occurred by fraud, false statement, or forgery. He was only charged with false statement. This court ruled that was a sufficient violation of that statute. The defendant tried to argue he shouldn't be held liable because he didn't have intent to deceive the government. And what this court said was, no, the defendant's trying to raise the intent requirement of making false statements, that part of the violation, and trying to graft onto that violation the heightened intent requirement, fraud. And that's exactly what the defense argument here is. Intent to cause death or serious bodily harm, all of those words have to mean something. And what defendants want this court to do is read that phrase as if the or is an and. Because if we don't have the rest of that phrase, or serious bodily harm, we'd have just an intent to kill statute. But that's not what Congress did here. And if this court were to accept defendant's argument and rule that a defendant had to have both the intent to do serious bodily harm and the intent to kill, that would be a pretty unusual result and an unusual act of Congress. And we know serious bodily injury means something other than intent to kill because the statute expressly defines it. It cross-references to 1365H. And that lays out that injury to a victim other than death involving substantial risk of death, extreme physical pain, protracted and obvious disfigurement, protracted loss or impairment of body member or organ. Clearly, Congress did not intend for a carjacking defendant to have one of those intents and then on top of that intend to kill his victim in order to be convicted under the statute. And, Judge, you touched upon this in your question, and it's exactly what the district court judge posed to the defendants below. If the evidence was perfectly clear, maybe it was on tape, that the defendants intended to shoot their victim in the leg in order to get them out of the car and get the car out of there, would that be a sufficient violation of the statute? And when asked that question directly by the district court judge below, defendants conceded that it would be. And it really has to be. Otherwise, there'd be.
Is that on the record?
That is on the record, Judge. It's at page 665 of the transcript. And it has to be so, because otherwise Congress would have made a carve-out for defendants who only intended to do serious bodily harm to their victims. And that simply cannot be the case. With respect to the harmless error issue, if the court were to conclude that the jury should have been instructed that the government had to prove defendant's intent to cause death or serious bodily harm, the evidence was more than sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that was the intent in this case. Defendant Carter saw Willis pull the gun from his pocket as they approached the vehicle. Willis pointed the gun at the driver's head and threatened to kill him if he didn't get out of the car. Carter was only standing a few feet away on the other side of the car when Willis said that. The gun was loaded. Carter told the passenger to get down on the ground. This was a stick up. I've got a gun. And then Carter stood right next to Willis as Willis was pointing the loaded gun at the driver and went through the driver's pockets, got his personal property, told defendant Willis, get the keys, and then got into the car while Willis was pointing the gun at the driver. This evidence, this court and the Tenth Circuit found very similar evidence overwhelming in terms of establishing the requisite intent under the carjacking statute. This court in Jones ruled that way, and the Tenth Circuit in Gurule ruled the same way. That's on page 25 of our brief. Counsel touched on the aiding and abetting issue briefly. I'll address that also very briefly. I think the evidence that I just laid out clearly establishes defendant Carter's aiding and abetting of the carjacking. And what defense counsel didn't say is that the aiding and abetting instruction was also relevant to the 924C charge, the use of the firearm in that carjacking. Willis had the gun, and the evidence was pretty clear that Carter was there to aid and abet the carjacking. There's a Seventh Circuit case, Taylor, that expressly rules those types of facts support aiding and abetting for carjacking. It's a case from 2000. Turning to the sufficiency argument, it was kind of glossed over, but I do want to make the point that kind of the evidence that counsel worked through that detailed basically what happened from the carjacking to the arrest after midnight, about 90 minutes later, that established the defendant's possession of this very same firearm, the only firearm charged in the indictment, through that entire time period. And for that reason, there. Defendants want the court to rule that as a matter of law, there's no evidence for a jury to find that it was the same gun that was found in the van at the end of the night that the defendants used in the carjacking.
Mr. Hedges, could I ask, why did you choose to draft the indictment, you collectively at least, choose to draft the indictment to identify that specific firearm where there was at least, you know, you've got these conflicting descriptions and then you've got this debate about chain of custody that you had to hand to the jury as opposed to pretty clear testimony that Willis held at least a gun to Mr. Anderson's head.
Your Honor, I have to answer that in the collective we, but I believe because there was only one gun recovered at the scene and because we felt that the witness's description of the firearm used those descriptions were consistent. I know the defendants at trial tried to point out that they were inconsistent, but they're arguably as consistent as they might be judged inconsistent. Because we only had one gun, we decided to refer to that gun specifically, and we lived with that decision at trial. We could not argue that any gun would suffice. We made that decision to charge one, and we stuck to that decision.
Well, I mean, that gun was loaded, and that's obviously relevant to the intent issue on the 2119 charge.
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, well, maybe that's it.
That was part of the calculation as well, Your Honor. I guess in connection with the joinder argument, this issue of propensity evidence came up, and I want to address that very quickly. There's a case from this circuit, the Kennedy case, that's pretty well on point here. 922G is a continuous possession offense, or it's a continuous offense, so the possession, the continuous possession of the gun by the defendants is relevant here. The subsequent robbery that occurred was not propensity evidence because it involved the very same gun and the very same defendants as was used in the carjacking. And if we did not present evidence, and it was not a great deal of evidence at trial, it was a short bit of testimony from the person who was riding in the van who saw them get out with a gun to do it and saw them come back. If we did not plug that hole in the evidence, there'd be an argument that who knows what happened to the gun when they got out of the van. And so we were entitled, and it was, certainly was not an abuse of discretion for the district court to allow us to put on evidence of the defendant's continuous possession through that time period. And an important fact, I guess, on the joinder issue has to do with the dates. I mean, the arrest happened on June 24th. So what we proved at trial was that the defendants possessed that gun continuously for 90 minutes. It just so happens that the end of that possession was after midnight, and so that's why there was a June 24th charge in count four. So that would have been there regardless because that's when the event, the arrest happened, and that's when the gun was recovered. I don't hear counsel arguing very strenuously that joinder under Rule 8 was inappropriate here. Clearly it was. The offenses were part of the same course of conduct, and they involved the same gun. The district court's denial of their motion for severance on prejudice grounds, that wasn't an abuse of discretion because there was no prejudicial spillover here of evidence between the offenses. And the district court ruled, again, that this continuous possession really made this direct evidence of all the crimes, the defendant's possession of the same gun over this time period. Now, defendants stipulated they'd been convicted of a felony, and that's the only evidence that the jury ever heard on the point about defendant's prior felony under 922G. The district court instructed the jury to consider that evidence only for that limited purpose, and there was no description of the felony. There was no other reference to defendant's criminal history. Nothing like that was ever presented to the jury. So there really was no prejudice here about that fact being placed before this jury. And really, as a practical matter, joinder was necessary and proper in this case. In every case where a 922G count happens to be included with a substantive offense where a gun is used, like bank robbery or a drug crime or a carjacking. If the defendant's position were correct in every one of those cases, the 922G count would have to be severed out, which would result in a tremendous waste of judicial resources, which is what the joinder rules are intended, of course, to avoid. Unless there are any further questions, I'll end by asking the court to affirm the convictions and sentences in this case.
Thank you, counsel. And the time for defense counsel expired. Do you have anything else, Mr. Shuler?
Respond to 2 points. One, that the government cited the Jones case in this court as holding that all the law requires is intent to do the driver harm. But in fact, that case makes explicitly clear following Holloway that that it has to have a serious, I'll quote, have to have at least attempted to seriously harm or kill the driver if the action had been necessary to complete the taking of the car. And that's quoting directly from Holloway, and that's in the, right before the portion that the prosecutor read. Secondly, he indicated that at page 667 in the transcript that it was conceded that if there had been, if the hypothetical had been that the defendant intended to shoot the victim in the leg, and that's all it shows, would that be sufficient evidence? And the response was, I think that might satisfy it as a factual matter. That might satisfy the offense. But then went on to say, but I do think that the focus on death and intent to kill is potentially inflammatory, but it also gives flavor and character to the kind of intent that the defendants had to have. So to the extent that the government is trying to suggest that the issue was waived, it clearly was not waived. There was clearly objection on the record each time with respect to that. And we don't believe in that hypothetical, or in our case, that it would have been sufficient.
Thank you. Were you both appointed in this case?
Yes.
Well, thank you for, on behalf of the court, for your fine representation of your client. Thanks to both counsel, or all counsel, I should say. And the case will move to.